The Eagles were America's biggest band of the 1970s, remain one of the most popular of all time, a fixture in the rock world for over three decades. But according to Don Felder, the Eagles' former lead guitarist, life in the fast lane wasn't always easy. Don Felder joins me now to talk about his memoir, Heaven and Hell, My Life in the Eagles, 1974-2001, written with the help of British journalist Wendy Holden. It's published by Wiley, and I'm delighted that he was able to join us today. Hello.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Now, obviously, the title comes from the lyric of the song that you composed, Hotel California, but what proportion of your time with the Eagles was heaven and how much of it was hell?
Well, it was sort of a mixture evenly of both. Some of the best parts were obviously putting together the music, writing the music, walking out on stage and playing the first few opening songs of Hotel California, and having whoever was there, whether it was in Japan or Germany or in some country that they didn't even speak English, kind of erupt with a massive applause and recognition of that song. That was some of the most rewarding parts of it. There were a lot of difficult times that are spelled out pretty meticulously in the book. As far as the lifestyle on the road for any artist that's out, where you do a 2 or 3 hour show, then you wind up having 21 or 22 hours of downtime waiting till you go back to do another show. And those hours can be full of all sorts of temptations and evilness and trials and tribulations, and some of which I became a victim of.
And also, being a member of a group can have its positive sides. There's a real sense of family and unity, and also can have its negative sides, because in situations like this, there's an awful lot of ego, and there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of other things that might very well cause disputes. You wrote the music to Hotel California, and there was a certain amount of resistance to recording it at first, wasn't there? Because of the and that bridge sounds a little, almost a little Mexican mariachi.
Well, yeah, I did write the music for that song, and I don't think there was any resistance to recording it. I just remember when we finished recording it and actually set in a studio for a playback party where we'd play back all the tracks that were on the album. When Don Henley finally listened to the record, and he turned around and said, well, Hotel is going to be our single. And I kind of resisted that, because in the 70s, the AM format was such that you had to have a record that was under 3 minutes long. The introduction had to be like 20 seconds, so the disc jockey didn't have to talk too much before it got to the single.
But he wanted to talk over that first part.
That's right, and the introduction to Hotel California is like a minute long, so it's a long introduction. It kind of breaks down in the middle, so you can't really dance to it. And then it's got a 2-minute guitar solo on the end. So it was the absolute wrong format for what we were trying to do. We were trying to go from a more of a country band to a rock and roll band and cross over into the AM format. And that song was really constructed not with that motive in mind. And so I lost the argument, fortunately, with Don, and the song went on to do quite well.
How many of the songs did you write for the group?
Gee, I haven't ever stopped to sit and count.
Most of the material was written by Don Henley and Glenn Frey.
Yeah, a lot of it. Yeah, a lot of the lyrics and stuff were written for them and by them. Everything that started out when we started working on an album started out with somebody playing an acoustic guitar and a melody or a line. And we would get together in the studio and create these records. Everybody would write their own parts. So all the guitar parts that were written that went behind all the songs I wrote that I played on. So even though I didn't get writer's credit for the song itself.
Often the musical hooks,
correct,
were created by the musicians who were working on the session.
Correct, exactly. And so a lot of it went down without official writer's credits for the songwriting, but I played and recorded on every song that was done from 74 to 2001.
You grew up relatively poor in Gainesville, Florida, and it sounds like there were a lot of young musicians there at the time.
Yeah, I was born into close to destitute poverty down on a little dirt road in the palmetto fields of North Florida, just outside Gainesville. And for some reason, in hindsight, looking back at it, the people that I was just hanging out with and playing and being in different bands and with went on to all being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and being really successful. I remember Tom Petty was a young guitar student of mine.
Tommy at the time.
Little Tommy Petty, that's right. He was kind of a skinny, buck-teeth guy and used to come in with his guitar and complain about his fingers hurting, you know, and he was taking guitar lessons from me. He was actually playing bass in a band called the Rucker Brothers at that time, which went on to be the Epics and then became Mudcrutch and then later kind of migrated into Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So I spent some time teaching Tommy there in Gainesville and working with his band and going out and seeing his show several times and helping him just with their arrangements and stuff.
Stephen Stills was there?
Yeah, Stephen came into town and he and I had a band for about a year and a half. We were like Menudo. We were so young that nobody drove, so our parents had to drive us around to these different little shows around town. And later, ironically enough, after he had left Crosby, Stills, and Nash, one of my jobs later in life was to be Stephen Stills in Crosby, Nash's show. And Stephen and I are still dear friends to this day. We play golf together and have dinner with each other, and our fiancés and wives are very close. And
did you grow up with interest in music? You say your father was a big band jazz fan.
Yeah, he would come home from work. He was a very humble man. He worked really hard as a mechanic, and he'd come home covered in grease and get cleaned up and put on a tape of Tommy Dorsey or Glenn Miller or one of the horn bands. He loved horns, and so he would put that on and listen to it. We couldn't really afford records, so he bought a tape recorder, and we would borrow people's records and make tapes of them, and then when we kind of got tired of it, instead of buying more tape, we just record over it again. It was our way as kind of impoverished pirates, I guess, to have music.
And you got your first guitar by trading some cherry bombs for it?
Yeah, I did. We went up on a trip up to North Carolina to one of my favorite uncle's house, and he snuck a big box of these explosive things called cherry bombs into the trunk of our car for my brother and I. And in Florida, on this dirt road, it used to be paved so that all the water would run off into these ditches on the side of the road. And for the water to be able to get underneath your driveway, they put these big metal culverts that you would drive over. So when it was raining, the water would just be rushing down these ditches, and we would go out and light these cherry bombs and throw them upstream and try to time them so they would go down in the middle of these culverts and explode and make this huge thunderous noise. So my brother and I were out there while my parents were still at work during the summer throwing these cherry bombs in this culvert, and the kid across the street came out and wanted some. So I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a handful of these little cherry bombs if you give me that old beat-up guitar on the top of your closet. And he agreed to do it.
And then you taught yourself how to play?
I did, yeah. There was really no money. There was no music education in the school, per se, for guitar. So I started listening to things and learning how to play it myself.
By listening to Elvis and...
That's right, Elvis and a lot of the records that were kind of current at the time.
Well, considering all the people who were around, Tom Petty, you say, Stephen Stills, also Dwayne Allman was there, it must have been rather exciting. Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it just felt like you were growing up in some neighborhood like everybody else. Did you have any idea that any of you would make it so big?
I did not. It was just a bunch of guys that were hanging around town playing music in different bands, and we'd see each other's at battles of the bands. I think the Allman Brothers usually always won the battle of the band. We're just friends. And no one ever really envisioned us all going on to being successful, much less even one of us.
We have to take a little break, and we're going to listen to a little Victim of Love. But when we come back, I think we're going to come back with the first guitar solo you ever recorded. I think it's on one of those nights, right?
One of these nights, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm talking with Don Henley of the Eagles. He's written a book. Don Felder, what am I saying? Boy, the other Don, boy, he's ready to punch me. His memoir is Heaven and Hell, My Life in the Eagles. and it is published by Wiley. Don Felder's first recorded guitar solo. He's written a memoir called Heaven and Hell, My Life in the Eagles, 1974-2001, published by Wiley. Most musicians cringe when they hear their old records. What did you think of your playing on that?
I was very proud of it, to tell you the truth. As a matter of fact, I should make one minor correction. The first Eagles solo that I recorded was on a song called, ironically enough, Good Day in Hell. And then the second one was already gone on those on that record. And then this was the first one that I played on the album One of These Nights. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy listening back to the body of work that we did. You know, it was amazing when you think back about how we made those records. It was really five guys in the studio pretty much rehearsing it and working it out in the studio. Some bands go into rehearsal and they work out every detail and then they go in the studio and record it. We did exactly the opposite because you need to hear what you're doing and how it fits and subjects into the band.
Well, that could be expensive in the old days when studios were really went for hundreds and hundreds of dollars an hour. Today, with the kind of digital equipment that is available, you could do that and you could spend a year putting an album together and it'll only cost you couple hundred bucks.
Yeah, we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, making Hotel California and Long Run because that was just our process. That's the way we'd grown accustomed to writing and working and piecing things together.
And the record company didn't mind? I mean, no. they were going to have to sell an awful lot of records.
Well, they anticipated that they were going to sell a lot of records and they were willing to absorb the cost based on our track record, per se, that they knew they would eventually get their money back one way or the other.
Your nickname was Fingers.
That's right, yeah.
Who gave you that?
Glenn did. He watched me play several times, and I guess because of my dexterity on the instrument, he thought that was an appropriate nickname for me.
When did you join the Eagles? You were already working as a sideman at the time?
Yeah, I was actually playing with Crosby Nash. Like I said earlier, I was being Stephen Stills in that band, and I got a call to come down and play on that song, Good Day in Hell, just because I knew these guys as friends. And one of the boys in the band, Bernie Ledden, and I had had a band together in high school. So I'd been around them and jammed with them and just friends, you know, like the friends I had in L.A., kind of like the friends I had in Gainesville. And so I got a call to come down and play on that session, and I did and went in, and we had a good time, and I played slide guitar on it. And the next day, Glenn called me up and asked me to join the band. And it was a tough decision because I was married, and my wife was pregnant with our first child. And I had this solid, steady-paying job that was paying me $1,500 a week, which in the 70s was a lot of money. And a pregnant wife with a child coming on the way, and this band was very turbulent. I'd heard a lot of the stories from my friend Bernie, who had been in the band, about a lot of the arguments and tension and frustration, and I just decided musically it would be better to be able to make records with my own band or being part of a band than to just be a sideman with Crosby and Nash. So I made the decision, and very shortly after I joined the band, I had to reconsider, and I wondered if I'd just joined a band that had just broken up. Every day they were going through some trauma and some argument about
something. Well, they got rid of your friend Bernie.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
He represented a style they were trying to get away from, a more ballad-oriented, softer style.
Yeah, Bernie was a brilliant country guitar player. He played not only acoustic guitar, but he played brilliant electric guitar. If you listen to the early Eagles albums, it's all Bernie playing all those guitar parts. And he's just, in my opinion, really a gifted musician in that particular idiom. But they really wanted to shift more away from country music, which a lot of those early records were, into rock and roll, which was my forte. So
it's interesting because then we have other people, the Flying Burrito Brothers, moving in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
I guess it's where you want to go. Maybe the group just felt more comfortable, the rest of the members, with the rock format?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in those days, the people that were selling the largest amount of tickets and playing the arenas and stuff were the rock bands. They weren't the country bands. Country music now is huge. It's caught up. But in those days, country music was a very small audience that would come out to shows.
And you give the impression that as much as we'd like to believe that people were doing this for the art, in fact, they were thinking always about the commercial aspects.
Well, I mean, really, anytime you manufacture a product, whatever it is, you have to aim your market. You have to aim your product at a market. And so that shift from country music into rock and roll was really aimed at the AM market in order to break through to the level of recognition and performance in arenas and that sort of stuff. You had to be on AM radio, so that's really the market. It was calculated.
Do you think the Eagles could have made it today with radio being so different, or would you have to rely on satellite radio to get any play?
I don't know. I was just over on satellite radio before I came over here, as a matter of fact, and had a great time. It was funny because back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the radio stations were mom-and-pop owned. If somebody owned three or four radio stations, they were huge in that area.
Now they're all owned by the same company.
That's exactly right.
And they're all programmed out of one town.
That's right. And so your chances of actually having a regional hit or getting your stuff played on the radio, unless you go through the proper corporate control channels, you don't have a chance. And it's a very kind of manipulated environment right now. I don't know if... There are probably a lot of bands as good, if not better, than the Eagles that are denied access to airtime because of the control of who handles the transmitters.
And you have to be very much in a specific genre.
That's right. If
you're a traditional country singer, you don't have a chance today, even if you're the best in the world.
Well, you know what's really strange is I had a guy that used to write songs with me out in L.A. who used to be in an 80s hair band. He wore those big silver shoes and big puffy hair, and he would come out and a great singer and a really good songwriter. And we were writing on these songs that we never finished. And he came back about the fourth day and he said, I can't work with you anymore. And I said, well, why? What did I do? Did I say something wrong? He said, no. I've just signed a deal with MCA and they're going to send me to Nashville to be a country artist. And I nearly fell off my chair. I said, you, a country artist? And about 2 years later, I'm flipping through the channels and I come across the CMT, the Country Music Network. There's this guy that I hear his voice and I go, I know this guy. And he's got on a big black cowboy hat and the cowboy western shirts and the black boots and a low-strung acoustic guitar. And it was James House, and that's who the guy was. So you're right. You know, it's really a marketing. It's making a product at a specific market.
When we offered you coffee, you said you don't drink it anymore. But you talk a lot in the book about all the drug use in the music business in the 70s. Did you think of it as a problem at the time?
Well, I had some warnings. You know, early on in my musical career, I'd seen a lot of people abuse drugs, abuse alcohol.
I mean, there are roadies. You describe putting lines of cocaine on the amps so that you could snort between songs when people thought you were just adjusting the amplifier.
That's right, yeah. Well, you know, what happened was I was raised in a really, humble environment. I was dragged into church every Sunday morning from the time I was old enough to attend Sunday school and raised in a very religious family. And then in the 70s, when I joined the Eagles, I was drugged into all sorts of promiscuity and being drunk
and trying to maintain a marriage at the same time.
And trying to maintain
with kids.
A marriage. Yes, that's right. It was really difficult. And I was the only married guy in the band. And so all of the trappings of drugs and alcohol and fame and women and everything that go along with that magnitude of success were thrown at me like a hurricane.
It sounds like a lot of the fights were over really petty things like who stood where and who got what color spotlight.
Well, it was all over control. You know, the basic three really ugly elements that started surfacing as the money got bigger and bigger and bigger, it started turning to battles of greed, power, and control.
And I'm sure the drugs and alcohol didn't help the situation.
Absolutely. Now, there wasn't so much of that in the 70s, but in the 90s when we resumed with Hell Freezes Over, there were literally hundreds of millions, and up to this date, probably billions of dollars involved. And, the people that want control over that and want to take the lion's share of those profits, there were disagreements and arguments about it, you know.
You were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes, I was.
Which meant that you got to visit Cleveland.
I did, yeah.
Did you have any idea that you'd be fired?
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, in 1998 and 99, we were inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1998. And then in 1999, we were presented with an award from the RIAA, which is the Recording Industry Association of America, for the largest selling album of the 20th century, which was the Eagles' Greatest Hits, Volume 1. And nobody really day-to-day or week-to-week or year-to-year keeps track of those levels of success that you've reached. And it left me really at a mindset when I started thinking about all the people in the 20th century that had actually made records like Elvis Presley and the Beatles and everybody
Rolling
that you can
Stones.
Imagine. Yeah, that this record had outsold everyone. It left me in awe of, you know, this humble guy from Florida, what I've been able to be part of.
But I get the feeling that it was all about money, finally. That's why you were fired. You were complaining that the original deal was that you'd share the profits equally, and then suddenly that wasn't happening anymore. But some of the other guys, Joe Walsh, Timothy Schmidt, weren't complaining. You were complaining.
Well, originally when we formed, the original five guys that were in the band, we formed a partnership where we all owned one-fifth of this company that owned the name the Eagles and also owned everything the Eagles did. And as Bernie Ledden left, he surrendered his stock. And as Randy Meisner left, he surrendered his stock. Though there were only three owners of Eagles Limited, Don Henley, Glenn Frey, and myself. When Joe and Timothy joined the band, they weren't given ownership. And so really the only person that had any legal grounds to be asking questions about the company and how it was working was its CFO. I was designated CFO of this company. And so when I started asking questions, there's an old adage in Hollywood that says, amongst managers in particular, that says, a good rule is to pay your acts enough money that they don't ask questions. And so when I started asking questions about what deals were being made, what tours money we had grossed, where money for charities were going to, what charity the money was going to, just those sort of just minor details, like where's all the money going, the answer I got was, you're fired.
Well, Don Henley and Glenn Frey probably felt like they were the stars. They had written most of the hit songs. They were doing the singing. So they should get the biggest piece of the pie.
Well, that wasn't the point. It was the point of not having access particularly to accounting and being denied information. You know, the question poses itself, if you have nothing to hide, why hide everything?
They didn't even want you to publish the book. In fact, originally it was supposed to be published by Hyperion a couple of years ago.
That's correct, yeah.
So they sued you?
Yeah, when I was finally terminated from the band, just completely out of the blue, I was left with the situation of the only way I would ever get any recourse or any of the asset that I owned was to file a lawsuit against these guys.
Has it all been resolved?
Yes, it has been.
I'm not going to ask you how much money you got out of it, but Don Felder's book is called Heaven and Hell, My Life in the Eagles, 1974-2001, now published by Wiley. It's been a great pleasure having you on the show.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
I keep stirring my soul.